Okay. Well, it's been a little while, but we are back.
In the words of the great late Stained, Greg, yeah. It has been a while.
It's been a while, yeah. Very good.
What have those guys been up to, you think? One guy's still sitting on the toilet. Wasn't that the music video?
Yeah, guy? That's the one that Jarrett met, lampoons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's good, good pull.
The only way I would know that, I'm sure.
I thought they were at like one of the rock festivals recently. I saw a video of them. They were doing Louder Than Life or something. So they're still out there.
Good. So they're always- I saw this was like, they say AI is taking over. This was from the band Eve 6.
Okay.
They say AI is taking over the music industry, but I'd like to see AI get on a Southwest Airlines commercial flight, make 3 stops, and open for Hoobastank at the Iowa State Fair.
And open for Hoobastank. How does that make you feel? They had one hit.
Yeah, the
reason. The reason, yeah. I mean, great I'm song. Sure. But
all the Hoobastank fans are going to come flooding our inbox with...
Come for us.
Yeah, obviously you didn't listen to their entire discography. Yeah, the hell I didn't. Good to see that Mike Florida is floating around somewhere.
Floating around being... I don't mean to laugh, but yeah, Mike's been through it a little bit down in Florida with the hurricanes flying through there. Aline and then Milton right afterwards. Yeah, so Mike, glad to see you back in the chat. Glad to everybody that could be here. Welcome to another exciting episode of Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We do want to say hi to all of those that listen to the podcast, whether it's on Spotify or Amazon Music or any of your other podcast providers. And we also want to say hi to everybody watching on YouTube Live, Twitch, and Facebook Live. So appreciate you being here in the chat. We're going to have a really good show tonight. We've got a really good matchup, so we're going to dig into that shortly. But before that, I do want to say one quick thing. It is my wife's. I'm not going to say how old she is. It is my wife's birthday today. She is not with me, and I don't mean that physically. Technically, she's not with me.
She's no longer with us?
She's in Maine visiting her mother. So I do want to wish her a happy birthday. So I'm not going to say
happy birthday.
But we've been together. I've been together more than half her life, which is awesome. And she's the light of my life, and she makes everybody's life better, and I mean that sincerely. Anybody who knows her just absolutely loves her, and I love her a lot. So did want to get that, wanted to say that real quick. Other things to really talk about before we get into the movies. I saw 2 new movies this week. I don't get a chance to see 2 new movies. And I saw 2.
Got in your car and
no, went and watched them at home. But they were new.
Man, I don't. Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's hear about the movies. Go ahead.
All right. So I like horror movies, and being October, that's what I look for. I look for new ones. I saw 2. One was mediocre, and one was really, really good, and I recommend it. So the first one was Azrael, which has Samara Weaving in it, which is Hugo Weaving from Mr. Anderson. That's his niece, I believe. And she's been in a lot of stuff. She was in the Ready or Not, where she's the bride that the whole wedding party is out to hunt her. Great movie if you haven't seen it.
I have not.
She was in The Babysitter. Another horror movie. She does, as you can tell, a lot of horror movies. And this one was pretty good. It's just the weird thing about it is there's zero dialogue. There's only one character that speaks, and he speaks in a foreign accent, so you have to use subtitles. So nobody speaks English. The premise is it's after the rapture, and demons roam the earth, and the remaining survivors live out in the woods, and they've taken a vow of silence because they look at speech as a sin. So they tell you all this in the credits, but it was okay. It's gory. It's very gory. The demons that are trying to hunt them down are pretty creepy, and they're
sounds a little derivative of The Quiet Place.
Yeah, a little bit.
Meets The Walking Dead.
Yeah, they don't have to be quiet, but they have like a barbed wire around their little encampment, and it was okay. My biggest thing with that, and I think we've talked about it on the show. It ends abruptly, and I can't stand that. So it's just getting good.
And your hatred for people who speak in foreign languages. I mean, yeah, man, between those two, really tough watch for you, I bet.
Dang, foreigners took her gerbs.
I wanted to pick apples for 4 cents an hour. And here they all are coming here.
Yeah. How dare they? But it was okay. It's just like right at the end goes off and it just ends. And I was like, I knew it was coming too. You know how you know it's about to end? You're like, you better not end. Credits.
Yeah.
All right. The other one that I watched, and I watched it this afternoon, as a matter of fact, it's called It's What's Inside. Somewhat of a horror film, not too much of a horror film, but very good film. You look like you hadn't. Have you seen it? I
watched one a lot like this on XNXX the other day. It's one of the few porno channels we still have here in Texas. So
I saw you were going with that. I saw the twinkle in your eye as soon as the words "It's What's Inside" came out.
It's What's Inside. Yeah, you'll never guess. Yeah. I don't want to spoil it for you, but.
No, this one was good. I recommend it without giving too much away. It's the main gist of the plot is this guy has a device that he can hook these electrodes up to everybody's brain, and then you can swap identities with other people because it's basically like swapping a hard drive. So the group of people, they're all rich kids. They get together in their mansion to play a parlor game and try to guess who is who, but then everything goes freaking haywire.
A mess, I bet.
When they start to enjoy being in somebody else's body. So that's all I'll say. But as a horror movie, when it starts to spiral, I enjoyed it. I actually liked it a lot better than the other one. And there's a definitive ending. And it's a pretty good.
I can relate to these kids.
Yeah.
Because there's probably not a body on earth that I wouldn't enjoy more than this meat sack I live in right now.
I mean, we've seen movies like that where the people switch bodies and everything. And if it, like All of Me with Steve Martin and Lily Tomlin, that kind of thing. There was another one with Ellen Burstyn. I can't remember the name in the '80s where she became Jimmy Smits and he became Ellen Burstyn or whatever. And those are always fun.
Is this what happens in 13 going on 30? Or
I think that's a young one. That's where they just go back in age. They de-age themselves like big. Yeah. Yeah. Similar. Yeah. So this one was that multiplied by, I think there's like, I don't want to say there's like eight of them. And so what was really, it did make it occasionally hard to keep up. What I enjoyed about the film is they do these things while they're arguing with one another and the camera will flip and then you'll see who they really are. So you go, okay, that's right. The identities within their bodies have changed. They've swapped bodies around. So it does a couple of times. In the heat of the moment, I would forget who was who, but it is a good movie for as far as what it does. So I do want to say that It's What's Inside, not Eric's version. Eric's version is completely different. I don't know if I'd Google It's What's Inside.
There's validity to each of these films, and it's not our job to separate what is and isn't art. Well, cool. I thought you were going to tell me that you went online and ordered $17 tickets and you got in your car and you drove across town and you went to the movie theater twice in 1 week.
Yeah.
And I just like how, like my sense of like self protection would keep me from doing that.
What do you say that? Yeah. Why your self protection? What does it protect you from? Just being out?
From being out in the being out in the world, like leaving my house.
Right.
So that's like exhibit A, but exhibit two is like being around all the other people that exist out in the world that have all also chosen to put themselves through the pain in the ass that is going to the movie theater
these days.
And so it's the worst decision you can make on a weekend. And so you're in a captive space with a bunch of people who made the same horrible decision you made. And it's just too much for me. But I'm glad I forget sometimes that, like, when we're watching the Oscars and they'll be like, and this movie, which was out on Netflix, it's like, oh, yeah, some movies don't even
nowadays exist
in a theater. They just come out on your favorite streaming platform or whatever it is.
Or at the very least, they just do a week. But yeah, with my wife gone, she's been gone for a couple weeks. So I was like, I thought about going to the movies just to get out of the house, but it was like, nah, I don't want to go by myself. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, when we've gone to the movies the last few times, been horrible experiences. People these days, I don't want to sound like that guy. Hey, get off my lawn, you kids. I don't know why I did an Irish accent there, but still, you get the idea. But yeah, we went to see Beetlejuice, and the people think they're the star of the movie, mm-hmm. because this woman thought she was a stand-up comedian. Oh. So sitting right behind us with her friend, telling every joke, the phone coming on, you can see the light from her phone, looking at stuff. And it's like, why did you come to the movie? You know, why did you come to the movie? And, you know, like I said, other than that, what was good is we were at IMAX, so the sound was so loud, it drowned her out most of the time. But it was still annoying, the fact that...
main character syndrome has taken over, feels like.
Yeah, it's...
Maybe that's why I don't like being out there, because I feel like I'm the main character of all of this. And so when we start to have competing interests...
Yeah. How dare you steal my attention?
Yeah. Come on. Don't you know how starved for attention I am on the inside?
Aren't we all? Mike just texted in, I can't believe Eric shares my search history. So yeah, I make sure those are on the private mode in case you... You know, unexpectedly, you don't pass want away.
You don't want that stuff. You don't want becoming part of an algorithm.
You don't want to die. Just for you. Have you ever gone to a site that you probably shouldn't go to? And that's it. But the thought crossed your mind, man. If I were to die right now, this is left up on.
And they find me. Yeah. Well, do you have a You have a time out. One sec.
Good night.
Oh, yep. Say good night.
Love you guys.
Good night.
You gotta go. I love you. I'll see you in the morning. Love you, sweet girl.
Good night.
We'll see you in the morning.
Have to do your fatherly duties.
Hey, y'all, close the door on the way out, please. And be nice to each other.
See how cute they were and sweet they were, and then by the time they got to the door, they were fighting over who gets to close the door.
I thought you were supposed to beat them before you put them to bed. I didn't realize you actually hugged them, so I've been doing it wrong all these years.
That's the carrot, you know, that you dangle out in front of them, like, today might be the day that Dad hugs you. It never is, Greg. But it's the hope that, you know, kind of keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, exactly.
So... Right. Anyway, yeah, you have to have a technology buddy, a good friend of yours, who when you die, their responsibility is to stop whatever they're doing and drive to your house and grab your phone and your laptop and go throw it in a fucking volcano. And then, you know,
where they find the volcano, it doesn't matter. You just got to get one.
Yep. Me and my buddy Corey have, you know, a long-standing pact, so it'll be sad, you know, because I know his wife very well. We all went to high school together, and so I'm sure when he dies and I just come barging into their house, she's going to think I'm there to, like, console her and the kids. That's not what I'm there for, not at this time. Just show me where Corey's computer is.
Just walking out with the wires dragging behind. Yeah.
Listen, I got something I got to do. I'll be back in an hour. We'll grieve and we'll mourn.
I'll send you all the insurance paperwork and everything else that was on here. And then
I was told explicitly to take all of this hardware out of here. The cloud, I'm sure, makes it more difficult, but I don't know.
Yeah, anyway. It does. Yeah. Then it turns into a whole Terminator situation where you got to go to Skynet and pull it right off the mainframe. But that's
and with my problems with technology, what are the odds I'm going to be able to figure that out? Pretty slim.
All right. Well, I think we should get into tonight's battle. Before we do, for those who haven't been a part of this, Box Office Battles is a format of our podcast where we take a certain category and we take 8 movies within that type of category and we have them go head to head till there's a winner, and we declare arbitrarily who we think the best movie is of this particular category. Right now what we're doing is best adult theme sports comedy. So nothing like G-rated, maybe PG, but if it's overtones, but mostly PG-13. And so we've been doing this now for a few weeks, if you haven't caught it. And tonight we're doing the last of the first round matchup. So after tonight, we will have a final four. On our last episode, we had the longest yard, ended up as the winner. Who did it beat?
I don't remember. I was just trying to think the same thing. Well, do you have...
Oh yeah. Well then, let's look at the bracket. Gosh, I could have just done that. Why didn't I do that? It beat White Men Can't Jump. Cause it's been a while since we've done an episode. We've been away for about a couple weeks. So
this is the bracket. I got a text from a buddy who said, "I was listening to the Longest Yard episode. I caught that 9/11 joke you dropped in there."
Yeah, I caught it.
They didn't say they liked it. They just said they heard it.
Exactly.
They didn't know that they heard it.
So this is where
we're. Yeah. Okay. So White Men Can't Jump.
Yes. Gotcha. And this is where we're at. We have three of the final four. Right now we have Slapshot beat Dodgeball, Happy Gilmore beat Caddyshack in a close one, and The Longest Yard. Mm-hmm. Well, it was kind of close. We were tied. We had to go to audience vote. So for those of you who have never...
That was the week that we experimented with, let's see if...
we could push each other.
Me yelling at you for an hour and a half is good for the show. We realized it is not.
Well,
but... It was worth a try.
It was entertaining to me afterwards when I edited it and listened to it. I'm like, oh yeah, this is actually kind of fun. We're turning into the Real Housewives.
I felt real bad. You know, I don't have that Skip Bayless in me.
Exactly. You texted me afterwards. Oh, I'm so sorry. I was like, that was fine. Yeah. I said, yeah, my wife's talked to me worse than that. That's no big deal. But anyway. After I said such nice things about her, but no, she doesn't talk to me like that. You talked to me much harsher than my wife did, so I did cry afterwards. But
thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, and I'm not drinking tonight because, man, I am wore out after that football game last night. Went to like 11:30 with 22 penalties, and I had to get up at 6 for work. I'm like, oh, yeah, no alcoholic beverages for me. We're going to do this straight, which is water.
And raw dog.
Water, yes. Raw dog. Yeah, one way of putting it. But this is where we're at in the bracket. So if you look up in the top right, for all those that are listening just on the podcast, you just have to take our word for it. Our final two movies of the first round are Major League, which is the number 2 seed, and that is going up against Kingpin, the number 7 seed. Kind of vastly different movies, but from a similar era, the early 90s to the mid-90s. I think Kingpin came out in 96 and Major League in 92, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I could look it up, but
89 for Major League.
Was 96. It 89? Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Yep, you're right. Wow. Go figure. And 96. Well, I had one right.
Yeah.
I said 96 for Kingpin.
Yeah. Which one of these are we going to start out with? Because you say that they're vastly different, and they are, but I have a... So one glaring similarity. We're starting with Kingpin.
Yes, we always do the lower seed first.
Okay,
so
you think I would know that by now?
You would think so. You pay attention. There is a rhyme and reason.
Anything going on around me ever?
So we're starting with Kingpin, and for those that haven't seen it, well, you should see it. Maybe if you like offbeat, eccentric, quirky comedies in the vein of Dumb and Dumber, which was by the same directors, the Farrelly brothers. Who did a lot of offbeat, quirky, eccentric, bizarre, humorous films.
I think right after this one was Something About Mary, which is probably their bell cow. That, I don't know.
Dumb and Dumber. They've quite a few. Stuck on You. I always enjoyed Me, Myself, and Irene. But yeah, there's Something About Mary. Probably a little bit better than Dumb and Dumber overall. But Dumb and Dumber was such an iconic film for them. But that was like...
I mean, 90, I would bet you 90% of people, when presented with the stuck on a desert island between Dumb and Dumber and Something About Mary, choose Dumb and Dumber. I am one of those 90%.
Yeah.
For sure. And that's to take nothing away from Something About Mary. This Kingpin came out in 96. I was a senior in high school. I don't recall... this movie being that old. And because it's kind of, you know, bowling to me ages everything, because the heyday of bowling was in the 70s, maybe early 80s. It was on TV. There was big money to be made.
Right.
So any movie about bowling kind of, to me, like automatically ages itself, or any scene with bowling automatically puts me in this weird alternate universe where everything's 30 years older than it really is.
Yeah.
But the Farrelly brothers, like you mentioned all those movies, they had this edge that just was very unique at the time, was very different. And so I was excited to watch Kingpin again. I told you after our last show that I had seen this one numerous times.
Right.
And that I had never seen Major League. And so I was curious as how I might feel about it. And so I had not seen Kingpin, however, in probably 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And so a lot has changed since. I think for me personally, a lot has changed in the last, since I last saw this movie, and we can get into that here in just a little bit. So what's your experience with Kingpin? Saw it once several years ago. You've seen it a bunch of times. I mean, what?
Well, so, you know, I always liked Randy Quaid from the Cousin Eddie in the National Lampoon's Vacation. So we didn't see this in the theater, but I remember when it hit video, I really wanted to see this. And of course, I was a big Cheers fan. So Woody was just kind of getting off the ground with his movie career. And then the fact that you've got, you know, Bill Murray in it as well as Big Earn, Ernie McCracken. And they do a really good job of capturing that 70s heyday of bowling, because that's what I think this movie's trying to parody, is that those glory days and this catching up to them in the 90s. This was kind of like the death rattle of pro bowling. And so they're capturing this on film. So when we watched it, it was, I had never seen something so bizarre, adult oriented. I mean, Dumb and Dumber was getting there. It was really retraining your brain to kind of look at humor in a different way, because we had these cookie cutter type comedies that maybe they go a little bit overboard. And I could even throw in some stuff from the 70s, like Animal House, Porky's and all that. Yeah, they might push the edge, but nothing to where it was like the scene with his landlord. I'd never seen that on film before. And it was like, okay, they were really changing the landscape of comedy.
There was a shock value to it. I mean, that scene specifically, you know, it's, you know, here, try this, it's gross. You know, that kind of, if that were a movie scene, you know, that's what we're seeing there. Yeah, you know, that it pushed envelope. It kind of forced you to feel uncomfortable. At least it did for me in a lot of those movies. And this one, I think, of all of the ones you mentioned, has a much rougher edge to it than Something About Mary, which I found pretty zany. Me, Myself, and Irene, which I kind of found a little more psychological. This one really kind of puts you through it for being a comedy film. It's got so many, like you said, the people who at an early age attached their entire life and personality to their success as bowlers, which was a successful sport at the time. And then here, flash forward 20, 30 years later, and when you attach yourself so heavily to something that is in clear decline,
right,
it only stands to reason that your life would be in decline. And even Ernie, who is still a successful bowler, is kind of a caricature of once young, good-looking, slim, how do you pronounce the word that means you have a bunch of hair? Your sweet self, however that word is pronounced. I've seen it spelled.
Yeah.
It was an interesting watch.
It's dark. It's a black comedy in that sign of, it does have the zaniness about it, but it is bleak at times. And what's interesting for me is that, of course, Roy Munson, which is Woody Harrelson's character, ends up, you know, getting into an accident, which is Earn's fault, who sets him up. He ends up having his hand taken away, which is starts off in a pleasant mood.
With the ball return machine.
With the ball. And so he's you know, had that done to him when they're trying to hustle. And then he loses his career and he's trying to, you know, sell the bowling supplies, to, you know, for the different bowling alleys, from bowling alley to bowling alley. And he's can't make his rent. His landlord is so creepy. If you know Lynn Shea, she's from the Conjuring movies, but the Insidious movies, I believe that's when she's in. But she's as creepy as all get out, and she has to, you know, he has to deal with her. Unbelievable. I was reading in the trivia stuff about the film, and the Farrelly brothers weren't sure to cast Lynn Shea for this. And they saw this homeless woman walking around the casting area when they were doing auditions looking for an ashtray. And they tried to get her out. It turned out it was Lynn Shea in character. And they said, yeah. Oh, well, we're not looking at anybody else for this role. And it's so, I've seen movies where people hit rock bottom. This typifies rock bottom. This is probably his look. He steals a baby's bottle to put milk in his coffee. They're making it clear that this is a guy that had it all. And now he is at a lowest point in his life.
Yep.
It carries that way. But it builds. One of the things that I'll say is that as bleak as it is in the beginning, when things are at their lowest and he meets Ishmael, which is played by Randy Quaid, it becomes this contrast. Ishmael is an angelic character. You know, he's Amish. He's pure, and the one thing he likes to do is his grandfather used to take him bowling, and he bowls really well. And Woody sees a chance, or Roy Munson sees a chance to take Ishmael on the road and regain his former glory using this kid, who's not really a kid. But what's so brilliant about Randy Quaid's performance is he acts so innocent and so angelic. He pulls it off so well that it becomes this contrast of these two characters.
He's untainted by the world. It's set up that way on purpose. They make him Amish on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a play on the Amish working hard joke that surfaces, you know, midway through the film. I'm certain that this is the same for everybody. It's having kids for me, Greg, made me so much more sensitive. And I mean that in the good way and the bad way.
Right.
The good way that I would like to think that I do a better job of recognizing how other people are feeling, and, you know, that I don't have to understand what people are going through, but I do have to give them respect. And that's the good part of it. The bad part of it is that things that I probably used to find funnier or, I don't know, not as problematic, now really hit me like a ton of bricks. And I found myself during this watch, and this is probably the first time I've seen it since I had kids, that Roy's main motivation here is to take advantage of someone who is kind of a light to the world. And there was a time where that didn't bother me. That was just part of the plot. And that just kind of was like how we're going to get from point A to point B to point C. And in this watch, I was very aggravated by that. I didn't, you know, we already know that Roy is a tragic character.
Mm-hmm.
And he's willing to do despicable things either out of just plain selfishness or out of kind of a survival instinct of sorts. And I couldn't see the survival instinct in it. I just saw selfishness. I just saw, and it really bothered me a lot more than it did 10, 15 years ago when I last saw this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I am, I am insensitive in certain areas. Like I said, I don't like unlikable characters in a lot of films. And so when a character is self-destructive, it bothers me. But I think in this vein, where it's so over the top, I found it completely hilarious again. Like the fact that he stages the robbery and then he's in there with the robber settling up and his landlord walks in and he takes the coffee, he throws it in the guy's face and throws him out the window. I there was times watching this again, even though you could call it mean-spirited. I think even back in the day, a lot of critics hated this movie because it was mean-spirited, that it was, that it punched down on a lot of different groups. And I get it, but I also get that what this movie is trying to do is balance those hits with a redemption type arc of a story. And so you have to get there to enjoy it. And some of the stuff that they make fun of, I don't find it that offensive. You know, making fun of the Amish, everybody does that. And this, they take it to a whole nother level. For example, like when Woody goes to the farm, the two big scenes where he's working on, there's several scenes where he's trying to convince them that he's Amish and he milks their cow.
I don't have a cow.
He's drinking right from the pail. I mean, that's a good, there's so many sight gags like that in the film. There's some great wit.
Oh, the little stumpy horse.
Yeah, the buttercup. He tell him to change the shoes of the horse. And then he comes out, one of the best things like that picture is when they're staring at him. And he goes, what, I got a book hanging or something? It's mean-spirited, but man, it made me laugh out loud several times. It's just,
I mean, and I did too. I you know, I can say I found things, you know, that hit a little differently that didn't take away from how funny I found it. You say punching down. I think I really tend to be in tune with that kind of thing. I didn't really feel that on this watch. Either.
Yeah.
But even if I did, like, the Farrelly brothers are under no responsibility to everyone's treated fairly and appropriately throughout the course of a movie that is about made up characters as part of a story. Like, what?
Yeah.
I didn't see that, but even if I did, like, so fucking what?
Well, so yeah, I was looking at just, you know, as I was, you know, watching this movie again, it had been a few years since I'd seen it. I saw that the IMDb, one of the reasons it's in our countdown, our top eight, is because the IMDb rating is a 6.9 by the users. The fan vote of this film on Rotten Tomatoes is really high, but it's the critics was like a 43 on like Metacritic, like over half the critics hated it. So I started looking at the reviews, and this is from back in 96, and so many of them found the movie to be vulgar and offensive towards certain communities. There's a couple of scenes like that, but like you said, I really am like, were they really that sensitive in 1996? I thought we were sensitive today a little bit, you know, but with good reason sometimes, but it's like,
yeah, the only thing wrong with Mary's, being sensitive,
and something about Mary, the special needs brother, is way more over the top than just doing the Amish bit. I thought some of the stuff in here was really good. Yeah, there's the scene where the Indians, or Native Americans if you prefer, throw the trash on at his feet and the single tear. And I grew up in the 70s, and that was a very popular commercial where the people are dumping trash and the Indian is standing on the hill, then the tear comes down. That's a hilarious sight gag. The fact that
is this a reputation that all the Farrelly brother movies,
I don't know,
had at the time? I wonder if you would see the same sort of critical reaction to, you know, because Something About Mary also had the guy faking a physical disability in order to gain, you know, Mary's favor.
Yep.
So I guess, I mean, we have said it before and we will say it every third episode until, you know, this thing, we sign off for the final time. The critics are intended to be critical of things, and that's an easy thing for critics to latch onto and be critical about.
Right.
When maybe you don't, maybe they didn't find many flaws with the storytelling or the character development or the writing or the actors themselves portraying the characters. If you are looking for something to have a problem with, well, that's a really easy way to go about it. But in 96, like you said, that does surprise me quite a bit.
When I look at this film, because, you know, 96 was when things started to really change from out of the 80s. The early 90s, comedy started to get a little edgier. And I think part of the reason was the Farrelly Brothers and Dumb and Dumber kind of changed everything the way we looked at comedies. And, you know, then you have the Chris Farley movies like Tommy Boy, and then you get the Adam Sandler roles in, and everything started to change. Speaking of Chris Farley, he was up for the role of Ishmael, and it would have changed the movie completely. I think Chris Farley could have pulled it off.
Sure.
Yeah, I think he's, like in Tommy Boy, he plays that kind of angelic, childish character, and I think he would have been almost as funny in this. But I'm glad it was Randy Quaid. I would
argue, Greg, and it's probably not the point of this particular show, that it is the influence of David Spade in those movies that took us from 80s yuck comedy to the edge that we started to see later on in the 90s. Because Chris Farley, as much of a comic genius as he was still kind of a yuck monkey physical comedian, the over the top stuff kind of in the vein of the Belushi kind of acting out type of stuff. But it was Spade with that smug, straight man, cantankerous,
right,
nonplussed,
great straight man
persona that he had in a series of those movies that I think gave it that grit that we start to see later on.
I agree.
And he was great at that.
Yeah.
By the way, I mean,
yeah,
one of the best to ever play a straight man.
I agree. Yeah. I agree without a doubt. And what made him perfect, it was like the harkening back to the old Abbott and Costello, where you had Chris Farley as the, you know, the kind of bumbling, you know, fat guy, you know, fat man in a little coat and stuff. And then you have the guy that just, you know, is totally over it, just cynical, but gets in the barbs. So, yeah, they were good. And so, yeah, this movie is, you can call it vulgar and offensive, and that's for sure. It definitely earned its R rating. But I find it, outside of all the vulgarity, I find it to be genuinely, I would say the best word I could come up with would be mirthful. It's very light-hearted at times once it gets going. The darkness kind of fades as Ishmael gets in the picture, and the tone takes on. And of course, Vanessa Angel comes in.
Yes, she does. Claudia.
Yeah, Claudia. And she... you know, they end up meeting her when they go to hustle this, you know, rich guy's, you know, at his own bowling alley down in the basement. And there's the great scene that I think everybody has seen, that if you've watched the movie, that is probably one of the best parts, is the going to the fridge.
Yeah.
And then she asks if anybody wants a beer. Then Randy Quaid, I'll get it.
Yeah.
Goes over. Brilliant. Brilliant. So, they do it. They become a trio after that. And then it kind of, you know, the film again, then you get this kind of battle between Roy and Claudia for Ishmael, where Claudia really just wants to be a part of it, but Roy sees her as a threat. You're not going to take away his gravy train.
Yeah. And then it's the three of them versus, I mean, for a comedy movie, one of the most unlikable, despicable, antagonists. Bill Murray's Ernie McCracken in this is such a fucking dickhead.
He is.
And it is like, at the very least, Roy being a dickhead, we're able to frame it around his inadequacies, his lack of success, these, you know, this tragic incident, although play stupid games, win stupid prizes, you know, type outcome for him. So at least you can try to frame it that way, even if the things he does probably go a little further than that explanation would allow.
Right.
But my God, this Ernie McCracken, just, and so we haven't, we're going to get into Major League here in a little bit.
Yeah.
But I felt, Greg, like this matchup was a battle of some of the most memorable characters ever put on film. I mean, at the very least in a sports movie.
Right.
Because, yeah, Slapshots had the Hanson brothers. Longest Yard had a couple of characters. But, I mean, you've got three in this film that are just top to bottom, stacked, memorable characters. And Major League probably has twice as many as this.
Yeah, quite a few.
That was the takeaway I really felt after I had watched both of them, was more than any of the previous three, just memorable character after memorable character after strong impressions. Now, and I wanted, so I wanted to talk to you about this because you have said before, you know, well, one thing I don't like in characters is a self-destructive character. And, you know, I've kind of echoed that same thing. We've talked about what we do and don't like out of characters. But outside of kind of the subjective, in your film schooling, what do they teach about kind of developing and building strong characters? You know, what are, I wondered kind of if you had some insight into what the, what academia says about character building, what makes them memorable, how you develop that.
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. And, you know, from the film school standpoint, one of the things that we did, it's like a whole semester was donated or devoted to it. And when you're writing anything, whether it's a TV pilot or a film, and you know who you cast, your cast of characters are, one of the exercises that they have writers do is they write from beginning to end a complete and other biography of this fictional character, who they are, who their motivations are. And then you use that as the model, the mold of what this character is going to do. So you predetermine everything, who their personality is. So I'm sure like with Roy, it was one of those where deep down, he's a good guy. You know, he's doing bad things, but they want, you want to put that in there. Whereas Earn is really a narcissist. He's a classic narcissist in every sense of the word. He could also be a sociopath because he has no sympathy for the way he treats Roy or anybody else. And I got a clip for that that we'll show in a little bit. But yeah, so that's one of the things that you have to do as an exercise. And so a lot of the stuff you write down about that character, their past, who their parents were, who their siblings were, did they have any, where they grew up, how that affected the way they talk, were they middle class, were they lower class, what is their identity? So a lot of that may not even go into the script, but you use that as a, whether it's one or two pages, you use that as that's the mold of where this character fits in. So I think that's what you see in a lot of films.
And maybe sports films specifically lend themselves to really memorable characters because sports outside of the movies is filled with,
oh yeah,
Babe Ruth and Deion Sanders and Dr. J, Dennis Rodman, you know, name a sport.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, very quickly come up with a half dozen of just the most colorful characters that the media loved, but the fans hated, that you as a fan of your team hated, but would have loved if they were on your team. You know, this is so, I mean, now that I'm, you know, just talking it through, maybe that's the thing about sports movies having so easily memorable characters,
right?
Is because sports,
yes,
is
and you
know, filled with that.
And we'll shift gears into Major League, but that's an interesting point because the guy who wrote Major League was a lifelong Cleveland Indians fan and imagined them, you know, this is what it would be like if they won the pennant, and based a lot of the characters on players that he watched growing up. Mm-hmm. So their identities in the film are based on real baseball players that this guy observed. So, and similar here, if you've ever seen Pete Weber in bowling, the guy that did the, who do you think you are? I am. I mean, a big flake dude, but, you know, but again, made it, you know, everybody's seen that clip because of him doing that. So, yeah, so there's a lot of character in sports and at figures that are out there. Definitely so many. I mean, that's, I think one of the things that's what draws people to sports is you end up liking your team, but you also end up liking certain characters on your team. I'm a big Kelce fan. As an Eagles fan, I'm a huge Jason Kelce guy. That he is a character. And a lot of people,
my grandfather, rest his soul, grew up in rural Southern Oklahoma his whole life.
Yeah.
World War II veteran, moved back to small town Southern Oklahoma and was a carpenter the rest of his life. Built houses in the area. When you needed a house built, just call Sandy, and you know, he did general contracting stuff and retired and traveled the country. And he was an elder at the Church of Christ there in town, very small, you know, church. And that man loved him some Dennis Rodman. Mm. I mean,
how much did he love him?
Enough to where when Dennis Rodman was playing basketball at Southeastern Oklahoma State University in Durant, Oklahoma, which is like 10 miles from where my grandparents lived.
Yeah.
When they had a home game, granddad would pack up, get in his old work truck, drive down to Durant just to watch Dennis Rodman play. And maybe Dennis Rodman wasn't the Madonna dating,
right?
That we knew later.
Later, yeah.
But even later, when all of that was happening, my granddad still loved Dennis Rodman because he hustled and he rebounded. Oh, yeah. He was willing to do the things, you know, that weren't seen as glamorous as scoring or, you know,
great rebounds. And, yeah, great rebounder.
And so sports has the ability to do that. My grandfather had no business idolizing this, you know, young, really off the charts weirdness level, but he did, and he always did. And sports can do that to us.
So what you're saying is your granddad liked to gander at the worm.
Yes. He
would travel for miles just to gaze at the worm.
Yep. And it would make us think long and hard about what to say. Long and hard.
Rest in peace. But yeah, no,
Dennis Rodman.
Not Dennis Rodman. No, not yet. Anyway, all right. Let's shift gears here real quick. I got a couple of clips from Kingpin that I want to show. The first one, honestly, when I saw this again, watch this movie, I had to stop because I had forgotten this moment. And just the line itself was so innocent and pure and sweet and funny that I laughed out loud and I had to pause the film and take a breath because I was laughing so hard. And this is the scene where Roy gets Ishmael up in the middle of the night and they're going to bail on Claudia and hit the road on their own. So this is a great scene. Enjoy.
The army evacuated everybody. A big military train derailed, and this whole area is in danger of being contaminated by a huge cloud of shit. A huge cloud of shit. Wow. God, I think I smell it. Come on, let's go. Come on, Mr. Munson. Claudia?
Roy, could we go have a little chat?
Surely.
Great.
Hey, everybody, there's a shit cloud coming. Run for your lives.
I think I smell it.
But when he turns around and says, everybody, there's a shit cloud coming. I was like, I don't know what it was. That struck me like I was doubling over. I was like, God, Lord, the way he delivers that. It's so brilliant. But that's the character. That's how the character is written. He takes everything literal and he takes it in the most purest way. And when he starts getting defiled, because there's other great moments, there's the part where you see Roger Clemens, which was great, and they have the whole bar fight scene, and they end up getting away. But the whole thing where he's frozen in fear in the back seat is just great. There's so many good moments with him that he plays the part so perfectly that makes the film in a lot of ways. That everybody has the role. Bill Murray, you see him in the beginning, you don't see him until near the end. But I think it's Randy Quaid that kind of really drives this film and is kind of the heart, is probably the best way. There's just some other quick scenes here. The bungee jumping scene and then the bathroom.
Taking a shit in the urinal, yeah.
It's just really too much. So yeah, he makes it. Now, we talked about Big Earn, and the Ernie McCracken stuff. Like in pure Bill Murray fashion, he ad-libbed most of his lines. And the Farrelly brothers were thankful because he wrote funnier stuff than they ever did. He had a reputation for this. He just could really do a lot of great stuff off the cuff. One of my favorite things he does is the diner scene at the beginning. When he tells the waitress, it's mean-spirited. And I think that's maybe they talk about the mean-spiritedness of the movie. But when it's done by a bad guy, it's similar to Darth Vader choking a guy out. They're cementing who he is. And the waitress comes over and he goes, how about you wash that perfume off before you come back to the table next time? Then he turns to the table and he says hi to the young lady, and the old lady says hi back, and he goes, not you.
Not you.
Not you.
Yeah, we're establishing he's supposed to be despicable, and he is. And
the lines are
funny. They do a great job of it, especially like you said, because for 95% of the film, he's not in it. Yeah. So we get some at the beginning, some at the end. We see he's not changed. He's still a cocky, narcissistic, jag off, but again, so memorable for someone. Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs only has 13 minutes of screen time or something like that. So you can make them, god, that hair blowing around, I mean, it gets me every time. His comb over look, he's hanging on to that because if he lets it go in a dying industry. Now, of course, they kind of have this setup where the world championship of bowling is still a huge deal. It's packed with fans from all over the world, and ESPN is covering it. And that's not the reality now. And I really don't think that was the reality in 96. Not that you couldn't make a living being a pro bowl. But it wasn't like this.
I did like when they do the pan where they're showing all the bowlers and they're all overweight, they're eating, they're they're kind of making fun of the typical bowler bod or pro bowler bod. But yeah, Chris Berman is one of the hosts. ESPN is covering and everything. And ESPN still covers bowling, but it's on the Ocho.
Yeah.
Going back to the dodgeball thing. But yeah, Ernie McCracken is as far as sports villains go, he's up there with Shooter McGavin as far as a despicable narcissist who will do anything to win. And this other clip we've got, he has one of the best one-liners that I've ever seen. It's such a crazy quote. But this scene, to set it up, is a quick scene where Big Earn runs into Roy Munson at the buffet when they're coming together for the Reno Open. So this is brilliant.
Hey, the Munson.
Big Earn, long time.
I'll say probably a year for every topping on the table. I heard a horrible rumor. Oh, creepy. I'm sorry. You know, for the first couple years, I felt responsible. How you been otherwise?
You know, in the last 17 years, a day hadn't gone by that I haven't thought about what I'd say to you if I ever ran into you again.
I bet. Hello. Oh, my God. Claudia?
You two know each other?
It's a small world when you've got unbelievable touch, right?
Now, that quote could be on a bumper sticker, and I would laugh if I saw it. It's a small world when you've got unbelievable tits, right? If he ad-libbed that, that's just gold. Comedy.
He must have. You know, I often wonder if working with Bill Murray is worth it, because I can imagine if you've taken the time and care to create, this process isn't quick. So developing an idea and a story and a script and all the script doctors that have to go over it, and then all that gets shit canned. But the end result is really great. And
the other line too, where he says, a day has not gone by in 17 years that I haven't thought of what I'm going to say to you. And he just brushes him off. And he's like, I'll bet.
Yeah, I bet.
And he's done. He's done.
And he goes, oh, creepy. You know, like.
He plays that role so brilliantly. And when he rolls the three strikes at the end, which he actually, from what I read, he did that for real. Those three strikes that he gets, that was all done in one take. And he legit told them that he could do it. And the audience reaction is completely genuine because they were shocked that Bill Murray hit the three strikes in a row. And shouldn't
he wins. Surprise us, right?
So then you have one of the things that I love is like the sports movie paradox, where the hero doesn't get to win. I kind of enjoy that. Rocky one is great because he goes the distance. And in this case, you know, Roy ends up, you know, getting the money for being second, which turned out to be more than he thought it would. Claudia ends up stealing the money that was bet against him, and they end up, going back to the Amish farm. And then by then you get that full redemption arc. Now she sees, you get a point in the film where Claudia sees what Rory could be, and then you have the nice tie it all together where they go back to the farm, and John Popper from Blues Travelers does a great song to finish it out. I had to include that still because I like Blues Traveler. I like the final song.
Yeah, but anyway, right? That's the it doesn't seem like it. For large parts of the movie, it doesn't seem like Roy. It seems more selfish than it does victim of circumstance. But by the end, I think we do, the pendulum swings closer to he was always a person capable of good, but you know, situation after situation, after bad decision, after putting yourself in bad circumstances, have just kind of stripped him of his humanity. Mm-hmm. That's the Roy we see, present day Roy, at the beginning of the film. But it's also in no small measure due to having had that relationship with Ishmael, seeing what goodness and kindness looks like. Sometimes we need that as people to see example. That's why thing is important and difficult, because you're responsible for ensuring that you raise kids that are kind and are well-adjusted and, you know, all those things that we want our kids to. And you have to show them that, because you can't just tell kids to go be kind. That doesn't resonate with them as much as showing them what kindness looks like. When, you know, Kelsey and I interact with one another, what is that showing our children about how you treat others? What is that showing your daughters about what they ought to expect from a relationship? What is it you're showing your son? You know, that kind of stuff is why it's so hard, because you kind of got to be at the top of your game. He needed someone to show him, I think, you know, that part of him still existed, that maybe to Roy it felt like if you're not scrappy and you're not only looking out for yourself, then you don't survive in this world. You know, maybe that's how it felt.
Yeah.
And seeing an example of, you know, you can exist in this world while thinking about others, while being kind of a kind, good-natured person. You can be that without the world just crushing you like a bug, you know? So,
it
does come full circle. Well, not first full circle, but we do get that arc that you're talking about.
I think that, it doesn't happen until close to the end, but I think it's when right after that scene with Big Earn where Ishmael breaks his hand and he can no longer bowl, but then he puts his faith into Roy, and who doesn't believe in himself, and but Ishmael does, and then he starts to bowl on his own. And then there's a scene where he rolls a strike in a big moment to force Earn to have to do three strikes, and he turns around, and Ishmael's brothers come for him and taking him away, and he's not there. And you genuinely see disappointment that he's gone, and then he realizes that he did it to himself. So when he loses, it isn't just the fact that he lost Claudia, lost the money, and lost the tournament. He's sad about everything. He's back to square one. And that's why it's so poignant when he goes back home and he pours all the liquor out, which is so funny because there's like 80 bottles of Jack Daniels that he's pouring out. But it's that poignant thing where he goes back there and he's definitely, now he's going to make a change. And it wasn't the bowling that he needed. It was the friendship. It was the what he'd learned, the friends he'd made along the way, the journey that he made. So yeah, it's a, I think that it's a film that, it starts off as a really dark, bleak comedy. It's definitely bizarre at times with the sense of humor, but in the end, it does have heart. It does have you invested in the characters. I think mainly Randy Quaid brings that out of you. It's like if Randy Quaid's character wasn't so sweet and angelic, you wouldn't care about the other characters as much. And he kind of is what brings out, like you said, brings that out of them. So yeah, it's a really good film, and we'll have to see what we think about it compared to the film it's going up against tonight, which is, like we talked about, 1989 baseball classic, beloved by a lot of people, very high on critic ratings and fan ratings, a ton of stars. Tom Berenger at the time was really hot. Charlie Sheen, Corbin Burnson was big on the TV show L.A. Law. Wesley Snipes, ton of people in this film, you know, and it's considered one of the best baseball films of all time. It takes place takes place in Cleveland with the hapless Indians, who are no longer the Indians these days, and barely anybody comes to the ballpark to see the Indians, and they decide to get get a team together. The owner decides to get a team together incapable of winning so that she can move the entire franchise to Florida and bask in the sunshine and have a team down there. But she has to be able to have a losing season. They have to come in dead last. So the hapless fans are the ones that have to resort, you know, to have to deal
with. Pay the price. Yeah. Yeah. At a time when Miami didn't already have a team. I think they were moving to Miami.
I did
in the film. Okay. So listen, I had never seen Major League before.
Yes.
The entirety of my knowledge of Major League was Ricky Wild Thing Vaughn.
Mm-hmm.
The Texas Rangers had Mitch Williams in the 80s, who was known as a Wild Thing, and we would go watch out at the old Arlington Stadium before the ballpark, before their current Globe Life.
Yeah.
And honestly, going into the movie, I thought that this movie was the story of Ricky Wild Thing Vaughn, and it's not. It's not about, that's not what this movie is about. He's one of an assembly. Yeah, the weather's great in Florida, says Mike Florida, who's been through two hurricanes in 3 weeks.
Yeah,
I mean, first of all, that was shocking to me because that was the entirety of my knowledge of this movie. But there are several characters just as or more memorable than Ricky Vaughn.
Oh, yeah.
He is not the, if you had to choose a main character in this film, he's not the main character.
No, not at all.
So I think that was surprising, first of all. The other surprising thing to me as I watched this 89, 99, 09, 19, 35-year-old movie, was how fucking hilarious this fucking movie was. And I guess I don't want to spoil and poison the well here, but as good a sports movie as could ever exist. And so we'll dig into this. You've got your you've got the slides lined up here. I will say I found it surprising. So Bob Uecker.
Oh, yeah.
We'll get into the cast here. Like, I remember him from these old baseball like blooper videos that me and my brother would rent from Blockbuster way back in the day. And he was in the Miller Lite commercials. And he's just known as kind of like the clown prince of baseball, right? It's surprising to me that even in 1989, the number of puns made at the, not at the expense of, but surrounding the Cleveland Indians.
Right.
And he'd be like, well, they're having a real powwow on the mound, or send up some smoke signals to the bullpen. Just anything that could possibly be like stereotypically Indianized, he did in this movie. It got me thinking, like, that's the way you would do it today if you were setting a movie some years in the past.
Right. Yeah.
But it just surprised me that that's, I mean, because the movie came out in 89. It's a contemporary to the time film. This film isn't set 20 years in the past. So I think that part surprised me, just how much they leaned into the, and again, I'm not here to discuss how problematic sports team names are to people or groups. And my experience, team names are very likely, as a white heterosexual male, to be different than other groups.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm not here to talk about that, but it just, it was funny that they leaned into that just so fucking hard.
Yeah.
Like, but anyway, that was one of the things I found funny.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, speaking of that, you know, the Indians, like you said earlier, are no longer the Indians. They are the Guardians. They're playing tonight. Not sure what the score was. I looked at it a little bit ago, and the Yankees were up 3-3 zip on them in game two of the American League Championship Series. But now they're the Guardians. They took them a long time to change that name and get rid of the Chief Wahoo character, but it's front and center in this film. So this movie is almost like a kind of time capsule to that era of Cleveland Indian baseball. Now, I'm part Native American, but I'm not an official member. I'm like 1/8. My grandmother was full blooded, and
you and Elizabeth Warren.
What's that?
You and Elizabeth Warren.
Exactly. We have a lot in common. But that being said, I kind of run with the George Carlin definition of Indian, where he talks about how people who get up in arms about the term Indian don't realize that when Columbus got here, he wasn't looking for the West Indies. India was back then was called Hindustan, so there would have been no Indians. They named him Indian after Indios, or of God, people of God. And so George Carlin, like, schooled us all on that. Like, you need to get over yourselves as far as that goes. And I have several friends of that community who don't look at it as a derogatory term. But, of course, we have other people who speak for other people, and we get rid of a certain imagery. Now, I'm not saying that Chief Wahoo wasn't offensive.
So that's where I would land on that,
But the name itself, I mean...
The name, but yeah, the big-nosed, red-skinned, big-teeth.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, we can debate that.
On the other hand, when I think about things like Redskins, I sit there and go, you know, probably could have chosen a better name. Now, that name's been around since the 20s.
Yeah.
But even if the New York Kikes had been around since the 1920s, I would probably err on the side of changing that name.
True.
If I had to choose one or the other.
The interesting thing about the Redskins is that there were so many, you know, Indian fans or Native American fans that was their favorite team, was the Redskins. And it was, it, you could look it up. There was a lot of groups that, that are still trying, they're Native American groups trying to get them to bring the name back. You can't, once that's done, it's not coming back. So
yeah, I don't think so.
We could talk about the virtues of that. It is the world we live in. We change things to fit into sensibilities of today. But again, the Indians back then were, you know, kind of a hapless team. The interesting thing you brought up, Bob Uecker, was the Miller Lite commercials. He was extremely popular in the 80s for those, where he's sitting in seats that he doesn't belong in, and they tell him, hey, you, sir, you need to move. And he does the whole famous line, I must be in the front row. And then they put him way up in the bleachers. And so he was known for those commercials because he was extremely funny in those. And the writer director of this film, David S. Ward, hired him to play the announcer based on those commercials. What he didn't know until they started filming was that Bob Uecker was the voice of the Milwaukee Brewers for almost 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he was like an icon in that realm. So coincidentally, I have a clip from the movie where, you know, like we talked about, they assemble this team of hapless losers. We get these characters like Willie Mays Hayes, played by Wesley Snipes.
Yeah.
And then several others, Rick Vaughn, who comes in as Wild Thing.
Pedro.
Yes.
The voodoo. What's his?
Serrano.
Serrano. Pedro, yeah, Serrano, the voodoo Jabu. Loving.
Yes. Guy. Jabu. No one steals Jabu's rum. But in this clip, this is like the first day of the regular season after they've assembled this horrific team. And we're going to let Bob Uecker take it away.
Again, everybody, Harry Doyle here, welcoming all you friends of the feather to another season of Indians baseball. A lot of new faces in Chief Wahoo's tribe this year as they take on the defending American League champs, the New York Yankees. And hopefully we'll have some of the names that go with those faces before their first at-bat. Anyway, listen to the roar of the crowd as the Indians take the field.
Very tepid.
Yes, sir, they love this club here in Cleveland. Just a reminder, fans, about Die Hard Night coming up here at the stadium. Free admission to anyone who was actually alive the last time the Indians won a pennant.
So, you get the idea. And he does that through the whole film. I mean, he has, yep. He probably, whenever they go to him, it like lifts the film up a little bit for those moments. He really does shine.
It's comic relief in a film that's already funny without him.
Yeah, exactly.
And it, like you said, it just elevates and it kind of, for me, and I guess if you know who Bob Uecker is or know that he was a sportscaster already, it kind of regrounds it in baseball, you know, because there's a lot going on in this movie, a lot of different characters, a lot of different competing interests, and kind of is a way to, okay, well, we've kind of gone off the reservation.
Okay. Yeah, I got it. I like how you almost winked at me when you said that.
So let's bring it back in and bring it back to the baseball here for a second, and then we'll, you know, let them wander off. So that was great. Now, Kelsey, my wife, our partner, we're not married, but we've been together a long time. She's from Cleveland. She still says, are the Indians playing tonight? So if that tells you anything.
Yeah.
And she is kind of one of those long suffering baseball fans, as I was until last year. The cruelty of baseball cannot be understated.
Oh yeah.
It is 162 games. And I watched, so I've got good friends that are Baltimore Orioles fans, and I watched those fans go through 162 games and to get into the playoffs. And two games later, your season's over, and let's try it all again for another 162 games. There is a special cruelty to baseball that doesn't exist in other sports. It's America's pastime. It's just, there's a romanticism to baseball that I think lends itself to film. And it's not just this one. This is a comedy, and it probably is kind of a lighthearted look at the sport. But like the natural, you know, like movies that really dig into what it was like to grow up with baseball, the boys of summer, the just, I mean, it's as American as baseball and apple pie and just, so I think I'm already drawn to films like this. And maybe that's why I had such a strong reaction to this, but it's like they took the perfect subject and then built this perfect story around it and added on top of that perfect characters to fit the story that they had crafted. And I found myself entertained from the moment it started until the moment it ended. And I have very strong doubts that Major League 2 or Major League 3 live up to this film. But this is one of those where when it was over, I was like, I really wish there was a suitable follow-up to this movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, the Major League 2, I don't find atrocious. I actually queued it up to watch again. I haven't watched it in years, but I remember it was okay. So it's definitely not one for sure. And here is Pedro Serrano. If he looks familiar, that's Dennis Haysbert, who was the president on the series 24, playing Serrano. But yep. Yeah, you see Wesley Snipes in the background as he's watching him ward off the curses with his snake. And what's funny is the scene right afterwards where he takes a little garter snake and he's holding it up doing the same thing. There's great scenes like that. Wesley Snipes actually has quite a few of the best sight gags in the film, like where they take his bunk out in the middle of the night and they just set it in the field. And then he ends up, you know, getting up in his pajamas and running the 100-yard dash.
We're introduced to him as he pulls up in a Volkswagen Beetle that's been modified with a like a Mercedes.
I think it's a Rolls Royce grill. Yeah, the grill in front. Yeah, he definitely he has so many of the good one-liners and the moments in the film. He's not one of your characters that you get emotionally invested in.
No.
Because they don't dig into his life like they do with Tom Berenger and even to an extent Rick Vaughn with Charlie Sheen. But it had
to be that way.
Yes.
For this movie to work the way that it, again, worked really well, was having these complementary characters that each contributed to either the story on one hand or the experience of the viewer on the other hand.
Yeah.
And they didn't go out of their way to kind of cross-pollinate those two things. We had a story, we had a major plot, and that already was good enough. That plot that they set up, you already talked about it. We've want to move this team to Miami. The only way to do that is for attendance to fall under a certain level. The only way to do that is to put together the worst team we can. Boom. There it is. I explained it in 12 seconds. So you've got that, and it's strong, and it's a core story, and you can decorate it with all of this kind of frivolous characters that don't push any of the plot along at all, except to be part of the team. And it's brilliant. It's done so brilliantly. And I think that's what makes it an easy watch, is I didn't feel any pressure at all to understand the motivations or dig any deeper into these characters than just to sit down and be entertained by this movie and by these characters and by this writing and by this piece of art that they put together for my enjoyment. And I enjoyed it, and they did a really great job of that.
When you compare it to other ensemble casts in a sports film like Slapshot and Longest Yard, which were definitely 70s, this had an 80s blockbuster feel to it, where they kind of set a new mold where they didn't get overly heavy with the drama, but they gave you just enough. Because you have the love interest with Rene Russo, which was a little on the cliched side, but it does have a gorgeous woman, but she plays a great character, but it's one we've seen before where the old love comes back into town and he's got to win her back. But even so, those scenes are done really well, and they're entertaining because it's believable. Tom Berenger plays it in a believable role where he's this real man, you know, and she's got the rich guy that's a little, you know, like a little bit too full of himself, again, narcissistic. And he shows him up at every turn, and you could clearly tell that she's with the wrong guy. And the problem being, though, that Tom Berenger was never ready to retire, never ready to settle down. So it's that whole bit, that whole gag. But the movie pulls it off really well as far as an underlining story. So you don't get, like in Slapshot, you had the story where Paul Newman's wife was done with him. He was sleeping around with everybody. And in Major League, it's a PG version of that, where it wasn't, had nothing to do with him sleeping around. He was just not there. And she couldn't count on him. And now he's back. And Slapshot, it's more realistic.
She's never coming back.
It's more realistic because it's the standpoint of she's had enough. And even in the film, even though he apparently loves his wife, Paul Newman, he's sleeping around, even in the film where he's professing his love to her. So it's a different type of depth of emotion where and I think it's the right tone for this kind of film. Because if Tom Berenger's character was like Paul Newman's character, it'd have been a different type of movie. It would not have been as lighthearted. This was what you needed. They even have the scene, speaking of sleeping around, where Corbin Burnson's wife, you know, goes after Rick Vaughn and sleeps with him just to get back at her husband, who she sees on camera.
walking off with him.
In a way, Corbin Burnson, who's not one of the main characters, he is that kind of sleeping around guy and gets taught a massive lesson, which is, you know, like as heavy as it gets, really.
Yeah, I think that we take comfort in some of that predictability. You know, this movie, and again, we also are looking at this with 35 years of hindsight and 35 years of cinema existence since then. But we're not meant to be challenged by this movie. And I think that's what's, again, it's a comfort. You know, there's a reason why these tropes, this old lover returns, the new guy is not the right one for you, let me prove that to you. I mean, you throw a rock and you could hit 100 movies with that same general premise. Right. In varying degrees of how serious they treat that subject matter or don't, or how realistically they treat it or don't. And this just seemed exactly perfectly average, and I mean average not in the it wasn't good, it wasn't bad. I mean treating it the way we as viewers just expect it to be. I just found this movie meeting my expectations where I was at as a viewer a lot more than some other movies that I've seen that either wanted to push me a direction, pull me a direction, set up premises to kind of manipulate me into feeling a certain way so that they could pay it off later or they could rip the rug out, or, you know, and all of these are valid ways of making a movie because you can do with the audience, you know, that's why surprise endings or twist endings. It's why those things exist. This one didn't need a twist ending. It didn't need to have the viewer pushed or pulled a certain way. It was entertaining for entertainment's sake.
Right.
And I think that's a special value that not every movie does right. Even when you're not trying to take your quote unquote art too seriously, you can fall into the traps of cinema, movie making. And this one didn't do that. For me, it didn't.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And that's what, like you said, it's set up with this cast of characters and they make it clear that these aren't, like we've talked about other sports films, these aren't misfits. Now, they on the surface, they may look like it. These are good ball players that have not been given an opportunity because for whatever reason. And then as the movie goes along, you think that this team that she's assembled is a bunch of losers. Tom Berenger, it's about his knees. He just needs one more shot. Rick Vaughn, it's about his eyes. You know, Willie Mays Hayes, it's about learning how to hit, you know, to go with his speed. They all have something. Serrano is a great long ball hitter, but he can't hit the curve. So you get this. They're all right there. And then you've got Dorn, who is Corbin Burnson, who is a fantastic player, probably the best player on the team, but he's more worried about his physical shape and not getting hurt than he is about winning. And once it all gels, and we, of course, the catalyst being they win a few games and then they find out about the owner's scheme. And it sets up this goal where they bring out the cardboard cutout of the owner who used to be a showgirl, and they peel off one thing at a time, one little panel until it reveals the entire puzzle to show her there. So it's given the guy's motivation to get to the end. So it has this, like, you see this goal, and that it's kind of typified by this poster board.
Now, another layer to that, Greg, as I was reading the trivia on this, and there was either an alternate ending or the original ending as written, was that she really didn't want to move the team. That was just a motivational ploy, and that she had assembled this team purposefully to be made up of overlooked ball players who did have usefulness remaining that just needed to be harnessed in one way or another. Audience hated that ending. It felt too contrived. I would agree with that. Although it gives you, when you talk about it, it makes it sound like it gives you a little bit more of a, oh, okay, things were going to be great all along, happy feeling to it.
Right.
But it would feel too contrived.
Yeah.
And viewers, test audiences, liked her more as a villain from start to finish, as opposed to she's a villain 90%. And again, this would have been one of those kind of rug pulls where, and it would have been unneeded, unnecessary,
right,
and kind of contrary to the overall oomph of this film to turn it around like that. So I'm glad that they went with,
I agree,
the ending that they did. She, you know, like you said, that the players are galvanized by finding out that she doesn't believe in them. They go on, of course, to great success, and Pedro can hit a curveball, and, you know, Willie Mays can steal multiple bases on a, you know, so
what is great, like you said, is that she stays the foil, because I always thought the GM guy was the one that was assembling the team behind her back and really making them look like they were losers when he was really being coy about getting good people on the team and working with the manager to for them to win. But one of the things that you're saying there, like everybody starts to do their thing, and then we got to get to Jake Taylor, Tom Berenger's character, who at the end of the film. So even though the Indians do win, spoiler alert, unlike Kingpin and Rocky and others like that, it still subverts expectations with the final scene, because it would have been so easy to have Jake hit the home run after he calls his shot, but it's just a decoy to so they could pull off the squeeze play.
Yep.
And then he just has to get to first with those bad knees. So it sets that up, and instead of being a homer, it turns out to be a you know, game winning squeeze play, which is more satisfying as an end. Yep. It could have been easier to have him do just like the natural and just knock it out of the park. So
what brilliant decision making by, again, I don't know what their expectations were when they released Major League in 1989. If they knew that they had created what we all consider to be not just a cult classic, but like ask people to name the top 8 sports movies of all time. And this is going to be close to the top, as it is in our bracket, as it is for most people. But we don't know that they knew that, you know, as it was released. But great decision making like that to stick with the formula in some areas, to deviate from it in others. But it seems to me like those choices were all correct, every one of them.
Well, like I said earlier, David Ward, you know, wrote it based off of, you know, growing up watching this team, watching the Indians and envisioning what a winner would look like. And I think they ended up winning the pennant not long after the movie came out, which is just prophetic. But as far as I could say, we talked earlier, just to finish on this for this movie, is that, you know, at the end of the film, they win the pennant. They don't win the World Series. It comes across as, you know, and the fans go wild. It's crazy. It's a wonderful ending. But they don't win the World Series. We don't even know. That's kind of a you know, do we need to know? Part of me was like, yeah, I'd like to know. But they frame it in a way where if you didn't know baseball, you wouldn't even know. They just won the game.
Yeah.
And that's all that's important. But I will say this, is that we talked earlier about baseball being a pastime. And of course, it's not what it was in the 70s and 80s. In the 70s and 80s, and even going back, you know, that's just my era that I can relate to it. It was the dominant sport. And now we've clearly, you know, basketball in the NBA wasn't even on television.
Dude,
hockey was only on
me. To find out that in my lifetime, they were showing the NBA finals on tape delay.
Yes. Nobody cared.
Like, I would have never guessed that. Nobody cared. The multi-billion dollar industry. Yes. They can all thank David Stern for that. But
hockey was only on in Canada. That was huge, but not much. Only time I ever saw hockey was maybe a local broadcast in the 70s. Later on in the 80s, yes, it became a thing. But you'd watch Canadian CBC, you know, Hockey Night in Canada was the only time you saw it. So baseball and football were it, and now clearly the NFL is taking over our hearts and minds. And baseball's still around. You turn on the game tonight, the playoff game, and the stands will be packed in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Money has kind of taken over it, but there was a magic in the 80s. So just to finish on this is that I was grew up in Detroit, Tigers fan. When I was 13, they won the World Series. I think I was 14 in 84, 85. Just a wonderful year.
Trammell and Whitaker and...
Yeah, and Kirk Gibson, Jack Morris. But in 87, I was 16, and they had gone down to the last game of the season, and it was either them or the Toronto Blue Jays. If the Tigers won, they were going to they would win the American League East and go to the playoffs. And if the Blue Jays won, then they went. So me and some friends got on a bus, got $5 tickets to sit in the bleachers and watch this epic game. And I could still recall the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It was Jimmy Key versus Frank Tanana. Jimmy Key pitching for the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
It's crazy what you remember.
Yeah.
Frank Tanana in this 1987. And in that game, there was one run scored. And it was Tom Brookins hit a homer into a right field just over the fence. And the Tigers won 1-0. And the atmosphere after that game. Now they went on and lost unbelievably and ironically to Jack Morris and the Minnesota Twins in the playoffs that year. But I still remember the feeling of that game as a 16-year-old. And that atmosphere, we don't get that so much today. I mean, even today when a team wins, it doesn't still have that electricity. But what this movie does above everything else is it tries to capture what that's like when your team, who hasn't won anything, and you talked about it with the Rangers, all of a sudden becomes a winner. So, yes, it's funny from start to finish as far as what it's setting out to do with each of these character studies, but it's also triumphant.
Yes.
Because it captures that very, very well that sometimes other sports movies may not necessarily do. So I agree with you. It is one of the favorite sports movies for a reason. Now, have I seen better baseball movies? I've seen a bunch of good baseball movies. Top of my head, I love Eight Men Out, but that's not a comedy.
Yeah.
The Black Sox story. That's one of my favorite. Field of Dreams. Amazing. Mm-hmm. There's so many good baseball movies out there. But I think when we stack all baseball movies up, and I'm sure other people know other ones that they really love, this would be have to go in there with the rest, even as a comedy.
Yeah, I agree. It's people enjoy, well, people enjoy movies for different reasons, but people enjoy a good story,
yeah,
regardless of medium, and people do like to laugh. You know, for the amount of time you're watching a movie and you're not thinking about anything else and you're just watching this. And so I think critics may lead you to believe otherwise, that, you know, funny movies can't be taken seriously as art or cinema, you know.
Right.
And maybe Major League doesn't need to be taken seriously, but it can be taken seriously enough, like you said, to be put on a list of not just the greatest baseball comedies, but just baseball movies. What are the best baseball movies? And I think you're right. This would easily hold its own with more serious films, more serious subject matter within the baseball confines. I agree with you. I mean,
it's easy. Sounds like an easy vote.
No surprise.
Sounds like an easy vote. I think we're not going to need to go to the fans on this one. And I'll say real quick, kudos to Kingpin, though. It does deserve its place in the top eight, in my opinion. It, as dark as it can be sometimes, I genuinely got big laughs out of it. And there's nothing wrong with it as a film. It's an enjoyable, bizarre, what it is, a Farrelly Brothers comedy. I think it's great. But when we're talking about what the category is, and it's best sports comedies, Kingpin is more of this case study of, it has bowling involved into it, but it's got more, it's not got the sports element as big as it could be. It has a lot of other things, the con artist, you know, type ploy and everything like that. I do love it. I do love it. But I think that we can agree that Major League is the winner for tonight. So our first round final, first round battle winner, Major League over Kingpin tonight. So now we've got our final four, and it looks a little something like this. So this is,
you know, this is going to be, well, one of these is going to be easy. One of these is going to be tough. Okay. All right.
Well, there we have it. The final four, as it is, for those that cannot see our live stream and you're just listening to on your podcast provider, our final four is Slapshot, which is the number one overall seed, will go up against Happy Gilmore, which was the four seed, if I'm not mistaken, and the number two seed Major League going up against the three seed in Longest Yard. So the top ones have made it this time around. Yeah. So that's very interesting. But yeah, it's going to be a good final four. We are going to have that for you next week, the 22nd of October. We're going to do it all in one night. May have a special guest, or we may just do the audience vote right here and there. So join us for that. And with that being said, we're going to get out of here. Want to thank Eric for being here again, as always, being my friend on the mic and in life.
And
at the movies.
And forever. Marriage. Yeah, and Greg, listen, let me just say, you know, we're a week off schedule, and I just wanted to thank you as a friend for your grace and kindness last week. Had a little personal thing come up, nothing for anyone to be worried about, but it was pretty big at the time. And I just appreciate the kindness and grace that you showed me. So appreciate you. Listeners, be more like Greg. Be kind. Be gracious. And until the next time we all get together, most importantly, be excellent to each other. We'll see you guys then.
Sounds good. And I do want to mention to everybody listening, if you want to email us, you can tune in to the podcast, and you'll see on our screen at the bottom right there, boxofficebattles@gmail.com. If you have any suggestions or if you want to just place your own vote and your own opinion, that's fine. Each and every week, you can watch our live stream on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod, all one word, done all together. Or if you like the YouTube thing, you can go to YouTube and you can find us at Box Office Battle Podcast. Of course, we're on Amazon, Spotify. Look at the same thing, Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Do not forget to tune in next week, 22nd October, Final Four. We're going to do it at the sports comedies. After that, the week after that, we're going to do our Halloween Spectacular with our good friend, Sean from Jarrett Goes to the Movies, is going to be our guest tiebreaker. And we're going to do four Halloween movies, Halloween comedies. So you can go to our Facebook page and you can place a vote for your favorite to get it in the top four. Other than that, we'll say goodbye tonight from everybody at Box Office Battles, Greg and Eric.